As the British dug in for their long war against the IRA after the failure of their Sunningdale Agreement, they decided on two policies, Ulsterisation and Criminalisation. Ulsterisation was the idea that the RUC would be armed and would lead the fight against the IRA, supported by the UDR, which would be made larger, made it a stronger organisation. That's the Ulster Defence Regiment, by the way. And then by the British Army, which would support the UDR and the RUC. The idea was that we didn't want British soldiers dying when, you know, Ulstermen, you know, didn't create as bad headlines for the British government back in London. The other side of that coin was criminalisation. If it's going to be the police fighting the IRA, then you have to treat the IRA like criminals. And so they began to portray the IRA as a criminal organisation. And that meant that the British government had to take away something called special category status, which Willie Whitelaw had agreed with the IRA before the Sunningdale Agreement. Special category status meant that IRA prisoners weren't treated like ordinary prisoners. They could wear their own clothes, they could have their own meetings, there were special deals when it came to early release. They were treated as political prisoners, to some extent, or a little bit like prisoners of war. Now, as the British government said, well, we've changed our mind now, we're just going to treat you like criminals. Different rules started to come into prisons. And so they said, look, you know, you're going to have to, you guys, you're really going to have to wear a prison uniform. You know, you're going to have to, you can't have all these meetings that you normally have. And so the first IRA man sentenced under the new rules, if you were sentenced under the old rules for some reason, they didn't make you wear a uniform. It was only if you got arrested after 76 for some reason these rules kicked in. The first IRA man sentenced under the new rules, Kieran Nugent, refused to wear the prison uniform. So he just wrapped himself in a blanket, and that was called going on the blanket. Then the prison authorities told prisoners that they couldn't use the wash facilities or the showers or the toilet facilities without wearing a uniform. So the prison officers said, well, if you're not going to wear a uniform, you're not going to be allowed to use the toilets. You're not going to be allowed to use the showers. So then what occurred was one of the most charming incidents in the whole of the history of the Troubles, which is called, you know, dirty protest, which basically meant that they took their poo, for want of a better word, excrement, and smeared it on the walls. Because if they weren't going to be allowed to use the toilet, they were going to smear it on the walls around them. I think the idea was to make prison officers sick or something. I don't know. It made sense to them at the time. It's called dirty protest. So you could go with the blanket, you could have dirty protest. So these are two protests that came in. Didn't make a huge difference because there weren't too many people out there who were really worried about somebody who was running around naked in a blanket and smearing his poo on the wall. You know, that didn't really have the effect the IRA wanted. So in 1980, the IRA came up with a new idea, which was hunger strike. Now, hunger strike had been used very effectively by Gandhi way back in the 1940s. The idea was, you know, if you're treating us badly, we'll starve ourselves until you change. Now, it's actually a pacifist weapon. It's not particularly a weapon that's used because the idea is, you know, the violence is inward. It's on yourself. You're starving yourself. And so hunger striking actually worked. You know, it sort of had a noble history. And in 1980, seven Republican prisoners in the Mays prison began a hunger strike with the five demands. They wanted the right to wear their own clothes. They didn't want to have to do prison work. They wanted to be able to associate freely with one another. They wanted to be able to organise their own recreational facilities, in other words, their own pool tables and how to make a bomb class. And they wanted to have one letter, visit and parcel a week. Oh, and by the way, any sort of remission for good behaviour, you know, that we lost because we smeared poo on the walls and things like that, we'd like that back, if you don't mind. So those were their demands. The demands were rejected by Margaret Thatcher, who was new Conservative Prime Minister, who was, you know, tough, law and order type, kind of a harsh personality. Eventually, this hunger strike was called off in December with one prisoner, Sean McKenna, near death. The prisoners believed that the government had agreed to make concessions. So when they called the strike off in December 1980, they believed that the British government had said, look, we won't meet all your demands. We will meet some of them. And so they felt like, Sean's near death here. We've all suffered quite a bit. Let's call it quits. After the hunger strike stopped, the British government said, we never made any agreement. We never agreed to anything. And there's still a debate to this day as to what agreement was or was not made in December 1980. We simply don't know for sure at this stage. It seems unlikely that the prisoners would have stopped the strike dead unless they really did believe that they were getting some sort of concession. But how or why that offer was made to them, we just don't know. The failure of the prisoners to be given their own clothes led to a fury in the prison. And so a second hunger strike was arranged for March 1981. Now, that was going to be led by Bobby Sands, who would be one of 10 Republicans to die. And he'd be the first to die because the different prisoners who were hunger striking, they took it in stages. Bobby Sands began in week one, then somebody else would start in week two, and then somebody else would start a week later. And the idea is, as these men died, it would create rolling headlines and negative publicity for the British government. For the most part, the British population really didn't feel too much sympathy for the hunger strikers at all. So in England, Scotland and Wales, the British government probably gained by taking a tough line with the hunger strikers. The Americans did not like this at all. There are a lot of Irish American votes and they felt that this was ridiculous. But it didn't lead to long-term damage in Britain's relationship with America. The Irish government, of course, was furious. And put pressure on the Brits to come to some sort of a deal. But Thatcher took the line that crime is crime, it's not political. We're going to treat these men like ordinary prisoners, and if they go on hunger strike, they go on hunger strike. That's their business. What happened, though, in the hunger strikes is that, first of all, there was a huge amount of sympathy gained for the IRA. Now, in 1980, 1981, the IRA was in significant trouble. The British policy of ulsterisation and criminalisation, it was making inroads. British intelligence was making inroads into the IRA. It did give the IRA a fresh lease of life, and that's the first benefit to the hunger strikes, and probably one reason why the IRA did not want to call them off. Secondly, a decision was made in 1981, and this is what's interesting. The IRA have decided to go use this tactic of a hunger strike, which, as I've said, is a weapon used by Gandhi, probably the world's most famous pacifist. It was also used by the suffragettes, women who fought for equal rights, equal voting rights with men. You know, it's used by pacifist groups or groups who aren't interested in armed conflict. So first of all, they've hit upon the strategy of the hunger strike after dirty protest doesn't work, after the blanket protest doesn't work. Hunger strikes brought in, and it's not a means that you would normally associate with a terrorist organisation. Then in the middle of the hunger strike, somebody decides, well, why don't we get a bit more politically involved here? Because an MP died, a member of parliament died, and that meant there had to be an election for a seat. And somebody suggested, well, why don't we run Bobby Sands? Why don't we have Bobby Sands run for election from inside the maze? He can never take up a seat in parliament. That was a big move for Sinn Féin, because it was Sinn Féin, the political wing of the IRA, who would run for that seat. Because Sinn Féin, they wanted, now initially this was probably intended as sort of a propaganda victory. The idea was that this would show the amount of support there was for Bobby Sands in the Catholic community. But Bobby Sands won that election by a landslide, by an absolute landslide. And Bobby Sands was never going to take a seat. Sinn Féin refused until this stage to run in any election for Great Britain. They didn't recognise Great Britain. They didn't think Great Britain should be in Northern Ireland. Why should they run for election? But to get a bit of propaganda, they ran Bobby Sands, and Bobby Sands won. And after he died, they ran another candidate, and he won. All of a sudden, Sinn Féin realised, we can actually get people to vote for us. Now, I mean, that's not a bad trick if you're actually actively blowing up the country that the people who are voting for you live in. It's not a bad trick to be able to get people to vote for you. But it's almost as if, by accident, Sinn Féin and IRA, they begin to move along a political path. They begin to realise, well, maybe there are alternatives to fighting. And remember, at this stage, the IRA's had a few brick walls. By 1980, the IRA's beginning to think, maybe we'll never we might never be defeated by the British Army. We might always be able to keep going. But does anybody really believe we're ever going to be able to drive them out? Does anybody really believe we're going to be able to defeat the British in Northern Ireland? I mean, these sorts of questions were being floated around or sort of asked in the background. People were beginning to have doubts. And then all of a sudden there's this election. And one chap at a conference says, listen, will anybody object if with the Armalite, that's the M16, if with the Armalite in one hand and the ballot box in the other, that's where you go to make your elections, where you go to vote. So with the Armalite in one hand and the ballot box in the other, we sweep to power in Northern Ireland, or we sweep to power in Ireland. And the idea was that the IRA were starting to say, well, maybe we can use the two strategies. Maybe we can use both armed struggle and elections. But for the first time, the Provisional IRA in Northern Ireland is beginning to take elections seriously. And that becomes very important for the peace process later on. Sands, like I said, was elected, and after he died, Sands would die. Over 100,000 people would attend his funeral. The fact that over 30,000 people were prepared to vote for Bobby Sands, a convicted terrorist, still outrages many unionists. Many unionists cannot get their head around this. I remember when I was at Queen's, they tried to put up murals for the men who died in the hunger strikes. And the outrage and the anger amongst unionists even then, which is nearly 20 years later, it was tangible, it was extreme. I mean, unionists have just never really understood that, okay, yes, this was a, if you like, a pacifist method of protesting, but how can you forget what these men did before the hunger strike and the reason why they were imprisoned in the first place? So unionists have never had the same view of the hunger strikers as nationalists have. Who tend to think, well, tend to view that as, look, this is the moment when the Republicans began to realise that there was a better way than the armed struggle, that there, or at least there was another way. So there's that disagreement over what the hunger strikers actually mean. And that's one of the things in history. You get people disagreeing about the meanings of things all the time. But unionists don't view the hunger strikers very highly. They would tend to view them as, you know, guys who were in prison, who deserved to be in prison, and who foolishly went on hunger strike and were probably put under a tremendous amount of pressure to stay on hunger strike. And the evidence is there was a lot of pressure to stay on hunger strike. There was expectations from people outside. There was the expectations of people, you know, not to let your mates down. There may or may not have been threats. We don't know. Unionists tend to view the hunger strikers with a lot of suspicion. Nationalists tend to view this as something that the British government inflicted on these men, that the British government should have been more reasonable, that the British government should have backed down, and that really the only good thing that came out of the hunger strikes was this chance of a political deal for Republicans. The Republicans began to realise there was something better than armed struggle. Hunger strikes continued throughout the summer of 1981, but that's when Sands was replaced by his electoral agent, Owen Caron. There were protests all over the world, Paris, New York, people supporting them. It made the British government look very poor in the eyes of other nations. Eventually, a deal was made via MI6 agents. I mean, there was communications going backwards and forwards, and eventually a deal was able to work out where the hunger strikers would stop first, but not after 10 of them died, not after there were massive riots in Belfast. And that's something else that the unionists point to. They tend to say, okay, look, you can't view these men as saints, because every time a hunger striker died, there were riots, there were police officers killed. When I was a young fellow living in Glengormley, there were two RUC men killed who lived very near to me during the hunger strikes. So there were police officers killed. There was rioting. There was increased recruitment to the IRA. So these men shouldn't be viewed as martyrs. That's at least the unionist interpretation. The British government claimed that this had been a victory. Eventually what happened is the hunger strikers backed down, and then after they had backed down, the British government began to make a few deals. The Catholic Church had got involved and it helped persuade a number of hunger strikers to push for it, you know, to back down, the end of the hunger strikes. But there was a huge propaganda victory for the IRA, the hunger strikes. I mean, and at a time when they really needed one desperately, they desperately needed a propaganda victory. And to some extent, the British handed it to them. And it created worries in the south of Ireland. It created worries in the Irish government in the south of Ireland were particularly worried that Sinn Féin might grow in the south of Ireland and become an electoral force down there and challenge them, and they might be running against Sinn Féin in the south of Ireland, because Sinn Féin came out of the hunger strikes as a political force. Created worries with the SDLP, because the SDLP all of a sudden had another nationalist party to run against. Up until then, they had been the alternative to armed struggle. Now there was Sinn Féin in a sort of a halfway house. You know, we support the IRA and we're kind of linked to the IRA, but we're kind of not the IRA, and nobody really knew what the relationship between the two exactly was. They were linked, but they weren't the same. But nobody knew what to make of them really. But they were popular in some areas. You know, they stood up for the hunger strikers, and the SDLP had to face off against Sinn Féin now. So the SDLP and the Irish government want to do something. They want to do something to stop the popularity of Sinn Féin. And so the SDLP and the Irish government decide to come up with a plan to show that normal politics would provide a better way than what Sinn Féin and the IRA had to offer.